Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Since 71 podcast. My name's Stuart, I'm the founder of the website, and today I'm really pleased to be joined by Freya Holdaway, formerly of Crystal Palace and Northern Ireland. How are you doing, Freya?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Sun's shining today, so I'm in a good mood.
Yeah, definitely. I was doing some writing because I've got a rare bit of free time at the moment, and you've brought me inside, which has probably saved me from a little bit of sunburn tomorrow, so I've got to be say thank you for that. This is quite a unique one for me because normally when I've been running these, it's been myself and maybe sort of three to four others. So it'd be really nice just having a two-way conversation with someone without butting in. And I've got a habit of going off on a bit of a tangent. So when I edit these episodes, it's normally my own audio that I cut out. So it'd be really nice to hear from you, and I'll try not to talk too much. So obviously, I just wanted to kind of start off by just finding out a little bit about your backstory and your journey within women's football. And I'm led to believe you grew up in Wales playing for a mixed team at first, and then you joined your first all-female team, Newtown Ladies, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I grew up, yeah, like you said, in the middle of Wales. I started playing with boys from the age of seven. That was kind of tough. Didn't have the best of experiences. But my dad always told me it was character building. So I guess it made me, you know, quite resilient to a lot of things. But yeah, from there, then I went to Newtown Ladies and I started playing at 14 back in those days, a few moons ago now, that 14-year-olds could play in the women's league. So from there, yeah. So, and I was like quite a skinny kid as well, but I was quite quick. So I played a lot on the wing. So yeah, I was that classic. People just pinged me the ball and I just got my head down, ran, and then went towards goal. So yeah, I spent a good couple of years there, to be fair, 2 years. And then I went and trialled for the Arsenal Academy. I got in there, spent a year there, and then I went to America on a full scholarship out there. Yeah, and then I played out there for 4 years.
So those that are good at their geography will realise that Newtown Ladies play in Wales and Arsenal don't. That must be some journey. So obviously you're playing for Arsenal. What's the commute like?
Yeah, so with the academy, it's you basically go and live on campus there. So you do your BTEC National Diploma as well as playing football every day. So we actually were hosted in like a football house. So at the age of 16, essentially, I moved out and went and lived there for a year and a half. And that was fun. But yeah, where I lived in Mid Wales, Newtown was a good 45-minute drive from me anyway. And that was the closest club. So any away games were like much further away. So yeah, I always, you know, take the mick out of my parents for like driving me for hours and hours on end. And, you know, bless them, they'll always say it was always worth it. But yeah, the amount of hours that they must have spent on those Welsh lanes must have, you know, driven them around the bend as such.
Well, you kind of hear when people get presented with awards and things like that and say, I'd like to thank my parents for their support. And I guess that's a perfect example of the tangible support that they gave you. It's that time and investment. It's that's writing off a lot of weekends nearly.
Oh, I mean, yeah, bless them. Like, they used to spend Saturdays with my brother playing football. We used to always go and do that. And then on the Sundays, it would just, you know, it would be flip-flop. Then everyone would go and watch me play. And, you know, then as I got a bit older, like, mum would stay at home, cook a roast, make sure everything's good. So then when we came back, you know, there was plenty of food on the table for us. So even though, you know, Mum wasn't there all the time for every single match, she was then making sure then that, you know, the nutrition was right and, like, you know, I could get to bed at a good hour and things like that. So, yeah, like, my parents' support has been beyond belief, like, literally all the way through my career.
It almost sounds like you've got your own tradition. So that Sunday tradition of football comeback, roast dinner and antique road show.
I always tried to do that even towards the back end of my playing career, come home, put a roast in. Like, it was just something about that Sunday experience is always something that, you know, you can't explain waking up on a Sunday and it's game day. And then, you know, even after you've played, come home and have a roast, like, especially in those winter months, it just makes Sunday so special.
Yeah. So while you were a young player at Arsenal, I believe that there was a young coach named Emma Hayes that was working with you that seems to have gone on to good things. How was working with her at the time?
Yeah, I've always said Emma's probably the best manager that I've been under. I mean, her awards and how, you know, the achievements that she's had speaks volumes. But for me, she was always so good with player management, like understanding the person and their needs and just being able to communicate with you really around, you know, what you needed to work on, what your strengths were, things like that. And I always got on really, really well with her, to be fair. And it was one of those things that I've always admired her for the approach that she, you know, she takes to players and the game.
And so you're not surprised at all that she's doing so well with Chelsea?
Oh, God, not at all. And I think it's amazing to, you know, for her to be able to do that in the UK, because I know she went out to America and had a bit of a rough time at Chicago and then came back. And I think she was waiting, you know, she was the perfect person for the English game. So waiting for that to pick up, you know, then allowed her the opportunity to come home as such and display her skills and a management style here.
Yeah, I think she's definitely been a bit of a game changer. And the nice thing that you can see from what you said is she will inspire other people and they will bring that into their own management style, hopefully, especially when you look at the likes of sort of Magda Eriksson. Like, you look at that Chelsea squad now, I can't see a scenario in 10 years' time where at least four or five of them aren't in management within women's football.
Her being able to work with international players as well, you know, she draws people in. So I think that's just a reflection of how good she is as a manager and, you know, both on the football pitch and with people.
Yeah, you just get I've been fortunate enough to speak to her in a couple of press conferences, and she just seems really lovely. Yeah. She respects everyone that she speaks to, so she demands that back. And I can completely, the old expression about running through brick walls for someone, and I can imagine that every single one of that Chelsea squad would completely.
She wears her heart on her sleeve as well, and I think, you know, you sort of get that feel that, you know, if somebody's managing you that way, then you tend to perform that way as well, which is quite nice.
Yeah, I think I'm a big fan of Carla Ward, and I look at how she carries herself and whether Carla would say that she's ever been influenced by Emma at all. I've no idea, but I think they certainly have that sort of similarity where you have that level of respect because they're honest, they don't muck about. Whether they've had that media training or not, they don't pay any attention to it because they're their own person, and they realise people will respect that if they bring that honest opinion across. Yeah. So obviously,
I think Carla did really well, and I think that move to Birmingham was well deserved. So, you know, she did amazing things at Sheffield. So I think for her to go to Birmingham was a great move.
I think she's almost in for a shout for manager of the season, to be honest, because when you look at Birmingham first day of the season, I think they'd struggled to even fill a bench at the first WSL game. So for them to be relatively clear of the relegation zone at this stage is, I think, it's fantastic. It's that they more needs to be said about how well they've done given where they've started.
Yeah, and then especially with the you know, the stuff you found out about how the club's being ran and the hardship that's going on there, I think, you know, it's so difficult within women's football because you've got the top teams, and then you've got those who are still in the WSL team who are still struggling financially and with the support and stuff. So yeah, I think it's a difficult time, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something that regular listeners will know that it's something that's really important to me. It's making sure that while we build the WSL, we don't create a wide gap and a bit of a monopoly that other teams will struggle to come into. your former club, Crystal Palace, are probably an example where they've got a successful men's team behind them, so they could afford to give them the backing. And if, as I hope they will do in the next 2 years, they make the Championship professional, you'd hope that they can try and support that and support these clubs. And to a degree that if Palace were to get promoted, they're not just going to be a team that are going to struggle. That there needs to be that blurring of lines between the WSL and the Championship and the Championship and the National League. And that, for me, is the measure of the success of the Football Association in the women's football. It's not how well the pinnacle, the WSL, yeah, is marketed, and how that it's how they feed that down in the lower tiers. And the kind of the words that I'm hearing in the background is encouraging. They've just recently named the National League Board, so that encourages me that, yeah, they are going to look to do that. And I still find it absolutely bonkers that the team that wins the Championship literally receives no prize money whatsoever.
Yeah, it's madness, because, you know, these clubs and these players, I know players are at the heart of it, but a lot of people who even work within the club give up so much of their time. And, you know, it's about making sure that everybody is, you know, it's that equality versus equity sort of thing. It's making sure that everybody's in the right position to be able to, you know, move forward and progress.
Yeah, definitely. So hopefully that will continue to go. And the National League and that grassroots level, they just need time to actually play football.
Yeah.
And I think,
especially the last 2 years.
Yeah, I can't even begin to imagine. I think it's a real achievement that women's football were able to continue playing football with all of the lack of funding that they do have. It's I think it's a real credit. But just before we sort of go off too much and talk about sort of Crystal Palace, I just want to touch on your time over in America, because it's a subject that really interests me, because the standard is so high over there. Everyone that I've spoken to that's took time out there, they said the attention to detail is fantastic, such as when you turn up and you get your kit bag. Your kit bag consists of so much stuff. It's all female fit kits as well.
Yeah.
You feel like a pro ultimately, even though you're not getting paid.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I was in a fortunate position where I had a full ride with a scholarship, so I got my education paid for, and that was a lot of fun and definitely an experience I would never change. But yeah, you show up and the amount of kit they give you is ridiculous, like absolutely ridiculous, to the point where, you know, you get given a fresh pair of boots, and if they break, then you just go downstairs and get another one. Everyone gets the same trainers. You get the same travel kit. It's just really making sure that it's all unified. And I like that about the Americans, because they literally love their university so much. Like, even as, like, I remember my friend's parents were still wearing like hoodies and that they bought from the university that they went to. There's so much more money involved in it out there. They're a lot more athletic than what I would say we were back then. So we're going back 10 years now. And I think that was quite obvious in the professional level as well, as in like even international level. That's what gave America the edge over England, I would say, is definitely that athleticism. But I think England have definitely caught up, and the rest of the world are catching up with that now anyway. So that distinct difference isn't so obvious. But yeah, technically, I always said they weren't technically as good, because they weren't used to having a ball at their feet all the time. I mean, I remember from being 5 years old, I literally had a ball out somewhere, whether it was in the living room, if it was in the garden, like there would always be a ball somewhere, or a balloon or something. And like, I was always occupied with it, and they're not like that. And yeah, I felt like they didn't read the game as well, because we watch it all the time. And at that point, the Premier League and that wasn't being showed over there. And I sort of felt like university was used as a bit of a platform to help them pay for their way through education. Like I said, I'm going back 10 years now, so it might be different, but at the end of my 4 years, I went and tried out for the Philadelphia team. And there was me and two others that did get in. But that was the year then the league folded. So I was like, okay, fine. So back to the drawing board. Then I went back out to do my master's and then was out there for another 2 years, but I didn't play because they didn't have like the club set up where I was at university. So yeah, I took 2 years out, which was a bit of a shame, but you know, it gave me time to concentrate on my education. And then I started playing again when I came home.
How did you find being away from football that long? Was there any use it or lose it, or did it take long to get back into the game?
We used to pick up, like play a bit of five-a-side and stuff like that. But yeah, when I came back, it was one of those that you don't realise how much you miss it until you start playing again. And, you know, I went back, when I went and played for Palace, I was really like, I didn't have a clue how it was going to go. It was one of those, I was like, look, listen, like, I've got a good pedigree behind me with all the clubs that I play for, but I don't know how this is going to go because I haven't played for like 2-3 years. And then it just sort of picked up. I guess it was like riding a bike. You know, get back into it. And, you know, Palace were a good couple of leagues lower than what they're at now. So it gave me an opportunity to build up again. But then, you know, I think I managed to do quite well to then get an international career out of it.
Yeah. So we'll move on to the international career a little bit later. So how did the move to Palace come about in the end?
I was at work when I was working in London at one of the gyms, and I was just talking to one of the guys there, and they were like, oh yeah, I know someone who's down at Palace. And I was like, tell you what, ask them if I can give them a call, because nothing ventured, nothing gained. And yeah, and that's how it sort of materialised. I just cracked on from there. I just went down to a training session, played for the reserves for a couple of games, and then, got bumped up to the first team.
Did your mentality change after your two-year break? Did you come back more motivated, more competitive, or was it kind of just picked up where you left off?
I've always been quite competitive anyway. Never liked losing. So I don't think that ever changed. I think my motivation to actually make something out of a football career was stronger, because I was like, you know what, like, I've got an opportunity here to really make something of this. So I would say that, but anybody who knows me always knows that I always give 100%. I'm always 100% committed, and I try to lead by example. So I don't think that ever changed. But yeah, it was that the opportunity was there and I wasn't going to miss it.
Amazing. I know that you guys had some tangible success at Palace, picking up some trophies on your way when you found yourself in the Championship. Are there any huge differences that you could see within the club as they progressed and as they are as you left them?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I first joined, I can't remember what league we were in then. I think it might have been South East Division 1. And we trained once a week on a Wednesday. And it was as much as it was, you know, us trying to get somewhere, it was a really good like sense of like everybody was friends. Everyone got on. We made the effort to see each other outside of football. So there was that real social bond there as well. So then when it came onto the pitch, the chemistry was just fantastic. And, you know, there were games that we played in that we should never, ever, ever have won, ever. But we pulled through because we would genuinely work just so, so hard for one another. And then obviously the higher up you go, like we then start training twice a week, and then we start training three times a week. And then it became that thing of like, right, we're training three times a week and we're playing, like trying to find that opportunity to go and socialize while everyone's still working still. Everyone's still trying to juggle, you know, work, football and family and the personal lives and things like that. And, you know, that became difficult, but that chemistry was still there because we were spending so much time together on the pitch. It was just a different feel, but everyone was still working really, really hard for one another. And I think, you know, that ultimately is why we ended up, you know, continuing to progress.
And so what about from a facilities perspective? Did you find that obviously once you made that move up to the Championship level, did the club start to provide you more?
So I was lucky. When I first joined, the club literally just moved from the National Sports Centre at Crystal Palace to Bromley. So I was always at Bromley. But then again, as we moved up in the leagues, we were then provided the opportunity to work out in the men's gym at the men's Crystal Palace training ground. So that was good to get integrated there. And, you know, I think the higher up we went, that whole one club approach that Crystal Palace really have became more and more evident. You know, Kit, we were giving Kit, it was one of those, we didn't have to pay subs. When I first joined, we were paying subs. So yeah, for me to have been there throughout that whole journey, like, it's something I'm quite proud of.
Yeah, so I was fortunate to watch you guys set the FA Cup last year when you took on Southampton Women in that mud bath.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah, you guys are doing great stuff. I've become friends with Sherelle.
Yeah.
And just seeing her do well, seeing the whole team do well, it's brilliant because it, even though not all of the players were there during the times that you were started off, I think there is a core of players that just seems to be quite grounded.
Yeah, and I think that's really, really important. I think, you know, you get a lot of players who, you know, aspire to be in the WSL, and sometimes people see the Championship as a stepping stone. But at the same time, like you say, when people are grounded, they appreciate the fact that you've got to put the work in now to be able to reap the benefits later. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to progress anyway. So, yeah, Sherelle's a great character, a great person to have around the team, and she works really, really hard. So, you know, to have characters like that in the team, you know, it's really nice and it's really refreshing.
Yeah, yeah, and it's really pleasing to see the club just do so well this season. It seems to be that the Championship's really interesting this year. It's a league that I think is just going to be really fascinating over the next 2 years. And we touched on before we started recording about how important it is that league gets made professional. Mm-hmm. You look and there's always a bit of a grey area with, I think you've got four confirmed professional sides. And then you've got the likes of, I think Sheffield and I think Durham. I always hear sort of questions as whether they are professional, whether they aren't.
Yeah, I think they are. Leicester. And again, it's that making sure that clear division doesn't happen within the same league. And it's, you know, we were, like you said, we were talking before about the WSL, and there's that almost like you can see it sort of happening already. And, you know, it will happen again in the Championship. But I think if the FA provide the opportunity to make that league professional, you know, it gives people to be able to, you know, act like professionals. And not just that, I've had a conversation before, and you know, around like, I wonder how good I actually would have been if I didn't have to juggle an actual working career, and I got my 8 hours sleep, and I ate everything perfect every single day, and if I needed the extra gym session, I could fit it in somewhere along the line. Like, and I think, you know, with all these kids coming through, and you know, the way that the women's sport is going, especially with all these, you know, multi-million-pound contracts with TV companies, you need to be able to give people the resources to be able to perform to the best of their ability. And you're not going to be able to do that unless some, you know, there's some financial benefit for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So what you've obviously made your way over to the Northern Ireland national team. So that just goes, when you question at what level would I get, then you've already played international football. So it just makes you think, oh, actually, well, I could have maybe made even more of an impact than you already did. So
yeah.
is it a frustration you must think, oh, if only I'd been born 10 years later.
Yeah. I mean, I've had this conversation before, like the next generation who are coming through are going to be in a great place, but it's the way with everything, isn't it? Like, you have to think, like, you've paved ways for those who are coming after you, and, you know, you have to be satisfied with that. Like, you have to be satisfied with the fact that you've made a difference in the greater picture. And, yeah, I mean, football's always treated me really well, and I've seen parts of the world that I probably never would have. You know, I have my education paid for, so football's not treated me poorly at all. Yeah, it does leave a bit of a question mark, but you can't live life regretting things that, you know, you no longer have control over.
Definitely. So I've while doing my research prior to this, that I believe that there's quite a good little story about how you became involved in the Northern Ireland national team. Was that something you'd be able to tell us about?
Yeah, I'm not sure what story you've heard, but so basically my granddad's was born in Belfast, and he's obviously Northern Irish, and he's my number one fan. He's been there literally through everything with me with football. He was that person that, you know, if as a kid came off crying because one of the boys had a pop at you, he'd be like, no, sorry, not having that. Turn you around, push you in and be like, right, get back on there and show them what you can do with the ball. And I was having a conversation with one of the girls, Kira, who was at Palace at that point in time. We were talking about Ireland, and I was like, oh, yeah, I've always wanted to go over there because my granddad's from there. And she was like, what do you mean your granddad's from there? I was like, oh, yeah, my granddad was born in Belfast. And she was like, how have we never had this conversation before? And she's like, all right, I'm going to get in touch with the manager, because I was in great form at that point in time. She was like, look, I'm going to get in touch with the manager and just see what he says and then go from there. And the first call-up I got, we went to Turkey for 10 days, and that was completely different. Again, that was literally like living like a pro, because everything was so detailed. You know, you literally didn't have a single thing to think about except for football for 10 days. And like, I was just like living the life and the dream. Even though I was like 28, I was like, oh, this is what it's about.
Do you believe that you made that transition quite easily?
I think so. And I think being a bit older definitely helped, because, you know, like I said, I was in good form, so I had a bit of confidence going in. You know, being a centre-back, I like to organise anyway, and I was never afraid of, you know, going into a team with people I didn't know, because I just knew that even if I wasn't playing well on the ball, I could still have a massive impact on the game by organising people and getting people where we needed to be. So I think, yeah, I think that transition was quite easy for me, and yeah, I think I did quite well, to be fair, but I think that was due to experience more than anything.
Do you have an overriding memory from your time with international football, that little point you think, you know what, this is something that I'll take to the grave?
Yeah, I've got two things that mainly stand out for me. One was playing in front of 30,000 people in Holland. That was incredible. That was one of those where you literally had to pinch yourself to make sure you weren't dreaming. And the noise, I'll never forget how loud it was. Like, and you always wonder, like, how do these professional players communicate with with each other when you can't hear yourself think? So that was incredible. And then
how do you just wing it?
I think you just have to have faith in your ability and everyone else around you. So you've got to massively trust the fact that, you know, your partner will be where they need to be, you know, when they need to be there. And you know how coaches bang on and on and on about checking your shoulder. It's like, yeah, you've got to do it, because you can't hear anybody else telling you that somebody's coming on and where they're coming on from. So
yeah,
that was interesting. And also you can't hear what the manager's saying, which sometimes is a good thing. Sometimes it's not so good. So you literally have to just, you know, have faith in your own ability and massively trust who you're playing with. And then my second moment was probably the most recent, and actually my last game for Northern Ireland, is we played Wales in Newport, and it was part of the recent campaign.
What a game to end your international.
I know, right? So we drew, and it was my first international game that my granddad came to see, and he's 92 this year. So it was one of those that it was in Wales, which then he lives in Wales now, which was easy for him to get to. We drew 2-2. Yeah, and it was just like, I'm so happy that was like sort of my last game, because of just the setting was on point.
We obviously touch on your retirement shortly, but did it almost feel like, okay, I'm glad I've ticked that box. In your retirement now, do you have less of a regret? It's probably a better way of putting it.
Well, because I played,
you have that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, because like you said before, like, how much higher do you get than playing international? Like, don't get me wrong. Like, yes, I wanted more caps. Yes, I would have liked to have played WSL football, but I've played against the best players in the world. And if you can't say that, what more do you want?
So on that, it'd be remiss of me not to ask if there was a particular player who caused you the most trouble, or you enjoyed playing against the most, or relished, I should say?
I think playing against that Dutch team, who won the Euros the year before. Literally, there were moments where you just wanted to applaud the football that they were playing. But obviously, you're in the middle of the game, you can't. But
yeah.
the admiration, you're just like, this is unbelievable. But then you have to remember, this is something that came up recently. Every single player, 98% of the players in the Northern Ireland team are part-time. Every single player in that Dutch team was a professional footballer. So that's where again, you've got that clear division in standard. But again, I think it's about getting in the right coaches, because now Kenny's come in and done amazing things, and the girls are off to the Euros next year. Who would have thought when we were ranked 53rd in the world that at the beginning of the campaign that, they're actually going to go to the Euros next year. And that's phenomenal.
He's such a nice guy as well, isn't he, Kenny?
Oh, he's great.
I spoke to them in the build up. Obviously, I've been very fortunate to take part in some of the recent England press conferences, and you don't really get too much of a word in edgeways, because it's understandably we're quite small fry compared to some of the national mainstream media that are looking to get involved. But when I took part in the Northern Ireland press conference, Kenny would have been there as long as it took to get through every single person there. And you can even hear him chat to people on a first name basis. Obviously, those that are there regularly. It was just my first time, so I didn't have that. But straight away, he welcomed my questions. And I also noticed that there was a difference in questions. The questioning that came to the Northern Ireland cap, it wasn't that silly, stating the obvious kind of questions that you get from Sky Sports, to name and shame them. I notice a clear difference. They ask the obvious, and you think, well, that's not really. Do you think you're going to win this game? Well, that's not a good question. Ask them about the players. Ask them and go into a bit more depth. And I think he really appreciated it, and he touched on something that you touched on as well just then about how during the England for the England game, there were players that just weren't available because they couldn't get off work.
That's. How is that right at an international level within the UK? And Kenny literally, anytime we talk to him, he'll always go on and on about how well the girls have worked and how hard they've worked and how they've really taken things on board. So he's very much focused on, making sure the girls are rewarded and praised for the work that they've done. And I think sometimes he doesn't take the credit that he's due. But that's the way he is. I always got on really, really well with him. Him and I have literally sat down and had multiple conversations over a cup of coffee, most of them about football, but a lot of them not about football. But he has the greatest amount of respect for every single individual that he comes across.
Yeah, I get that impression of him. It seems to me that he would... He supports his team so much. He would do anything for his team. We again touch on... that sort of player management that with Emma Hayes, he has that as well.
Yeah,
he realizes that it's not something like that Hege Riise will have to worry about. All those players are available at the click of a finger. He needs to know whether they're everything that's going on in their lives. And yeah, he just seems like a really great guy. And I, after that press conference, I'm a completely paid up member of the Green Army.
Yeah.
I made a special effort. Obviously, I've touched on the fact that I was fortunate enough to get press for the England game. In a way, it was a little bit bittersweet because I loved being in the press box to watch the Canada game. But I still had on my laptop the score results and the Twitter notifications coming on for the Northern Ireland game. And I've always said that I will never watch football after it's been played because I don't have 90 minutes to spare, highlights maybe. I actually sat down and rewatched that game. It was all recorded because I kind of felt a little bit invested in it after having such great access and great conversations with Kenny. I was desperate, absolutely desperate to see them qualify. And when I was looking in the build-up for the Ukraine game, I was kind of looking at, oh, hang on a minute, Ukraine are up. I think they were ranked 24th at the time. And
there's
about 25 places different. And I'm like, oh, they've got this midfielder that's scored more goals than she's had appearances. And, oh, I can see this. Oh, this is going to be heartbreak, isn't it? I can see there being just real heartbreak at the last minute. And
it's hard not to get drawn in by them because, like I said, Kenny's a perfect person for that group of girls because they honestly, I've never been in an environment where people would literally lay on the line for one another. Like, they trust so much in what they're doing. And, you know, it's that it's got to be a two-way street. He can't massively trust in the girls if the girls don't buy into that trust. And the girls have to trust massively in what he's doing to then pull it all off. And I think, you know, he came in very open and honest from the very beginning. And I think, you know, the girls appreciated that and sort of, you know, everybody wants to win a game of football. Nobody's going into a job or, you know, going onto the pitch wanting to lose a game of football. But you have to be on the page, especially like when you're massively the underdogs. You have to all be on the same page, and it all clicked. So I can't wait to see what happens next year for them at the Euros. I can't wait because they will turn people over unexpectedly.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say, they just, that Ukraine game was actually, both of them were relatively comfortable in the end. And that was the bit that I felt the most unease with, because hang on a minute, yeah. It's that hope that kills you.
Yeah, definitely.
It was brilliant. And it's, yeah, and I can't wait.
I watched that. They released like a short feature last night, behind the scenes of, you know, the qualifying against the playoffs against Ukraine. And you see Kenny literally when they won in Ukraine, the girls were celebrating. He kicked off at the last whistle, was like, stop celebrating. We haven't done it yet. Stop celebrating. Like, relax. And I think that just says it all. Like, job's not done. And he's like all about getting the job done, getting it done right. And you could hear him on the side of the pitch being like, do your job. You all know your jobs. Do your job. Like, stop worrying about other people's jobs. Do your job.
Yeah, yeah. I'll try and dig that out, actually. It'll be a really nice little insight.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder, you've obviously touched on that Holland game.
Mm.
Going into that as underdogs, how do the coaching team approach it? Are they coming in saying, come on guys, we're looking to plan to win the game, or is there a sort of a pragmatism in the way that we prepare? And
I think, well, we were under Alfie Wyatt, and he we went with five at the back, and to be fair, we went down, we was 4-0 at half time, and it was one of those that we were like, look, like, you know, do you go out there and go, right, we're just going to do a bit of damage limitation here and see what we can do? But I think, you know, at that point in time, you know, we set up not to get hammered, and we ended up getting hammered in the first game. So the second game, it was like, well, let's not set up to not get hammered, because we did anyway.
Yeah.
So I think it was a much different approach the second game. And that was part of the World Cup qualifiers. That was a few years ago now. But I mean, yeah, you have to appreciate everything that, you know, the opposition does. But at the same time, it's that classic, isn't it? If you give them too much respect, then they'll run rings around you.
Because presumably Kenny will be going into every single Euros game saying, we're actually pushing for a win.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't matter whether we're taking on England, we're pushing for a win now. And like you said, if everyone knows their role and does their job, you don't have to put five at the back.
No, absolutely not. And the girls are in great shape. And I think he sees them twice a week anyway over in Northern Ireland. So he's got them in tremendous shape. They're just now starting their season. So the Irish girls haven't even been in season, which is mental to think that, you know, they've achieved this out of season. I think that's something else that a lot of people haven't appreciated. They've gone through their off season over the winter and they've still managed to come out on top of a playoff. Like, how does that even work?
Yeah, I'd love to see there being representation within the team GB side.
Yeah,
I've been doing a lot of research with regards to going back and looking at London 2012, speaking to some of the players that were involved in that and how the similarities in the process about how you start off with a bigger squad and then work down.
Yeah.
At that point, we had two Scottish players, the rest of it was English. Yeah. But I don't think that players should be brought in as for tokenism.
No, I agree.
But then I do also think that there needs to be a full representation. And you can't tell me that Rachel Furness and Simone McGill, just to name two, couldn't hold their own against any other WSL player in the England national team.
I mean, Simone's in fine form, both club and country. Rachel's taking a bit of a knock with her leg. which was really unfortunate. So, you know, hopefully she gets back fighting fit ASAP. But both of them, natural leaders, they both work so hard, and neither of them like rest on their laurels at all at camp. When they're playing, they just demand equality from every single person. And I think that raises the bar. And, you know, there are other players like Sarah McFadden. She's, you know, got a great presence on the pitch. Even when we played against her, you know, when I was at Palace and she's playing for Durham, like, you know, she's such the heart of the team. Like, she'd be another great character. And then you've got the likes of Ashley Hutton and Julie Nelson who are on over 100 caps each. And then you got a load of youngsters coming through, you know, more people. You got, I think, Megan Bell and Demi Vance. Both of them are injured at the moment. They've gone over to Rangers. Yeah. Then you've got Chloe, who's gone to Birmingham. So people are, like, venturing out into these professional teams now to try and make a difference. But I do think, you know, for Northern Ireland to be overlooked would be a massive shame.
Yeah, and as we say, there are players that can hold their own, and I think it grows the game within Great Britain. If you've got two players that have gone off to play the Olympics, that's going to have an impact because you're all going to be asking them about it, and it's going to help their mentality and breed that mentality within the whole squad. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. I'm not going to lie, I'll be really disappointed and really disheartened if it's just Lionesses plus one.
Yeah, I don't think it will be. I don't think it should be because, like you said, like there's so many characters out there. I mean, there's a couple of great Welsh players and Scottish players out there as well.
Scotland, that's a whole other... For me, Scotland, it's... That team is superb. You look at the players that they have available. Yeah. It's fantastic. You imagine dropping Caroline Weir in that Northern Ireland team as well. Football, that Team GB team... could do really good things.
Yeah, I was going to say, so it could be a team to, you know, you wouldn't mind backing, would you?
Yeah, my initial concern was that I don't think they're going to be well prepared enough. But speaking to, I don't want to reveal the player because that's an upcoming episode and I don't want to spoil a surprise. But when they played for the London 2012 team, they actually said, to be honest, we only had one warm-up game, but we didn't feel like that made a difference because we were all...
They did really well, didn't they?
Professional. Yeah, and they felt like we're all professionals. We're all playing at high level, and actually, because we had that mentality, we had one team approach.
Yeah.
Actually, it was just, even though she was, was a Scottish player. So anyone that knows their stuff, there's only two of them. And she said, actually, they acclimatized really well. They were made part of the team quite quickly. My worries about the Hege Riise's side being unprepared probably aren't a thing to worry about, to be honest, and especially when everyone has been playing over this time.
I think she'll have a headache choosing a team, to be fair, and I guess it's a good headache to have.
Yeah, definitely. But just sort of moving on ever so slightly, you're still young enough to be playing, yet you've had been forced to take the decision of retiring from competitive football. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about how that's came about and why you felt that you needed to do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I had three bad concussions in the space of 18 months. The first one, I got a really bad knock and got the egg on the head classic. The second one, I got knocked on the temple. Initially wasn't that bad. I mean, it sounded bad from what I've heard, but at that you know, specific point in time, it wasn't that bad. But then I came off the pitch and then ended up having two seizures on the side of the pitch. And then the third one wasn't bad as in straight away. So basically what happened was goalkeepers kicked the ball out of her hands. I've gone to header it as a centre-back. And then I was just like, this doesn't feel right. After that, I spent months with my ears ringing. I felt really like out of it for a long time. I ended up taking a month off work. So then I wasn't looking at a laptop. I was sleeping for 12 hours straight, which isn't like me at all. And for me, it got to the point where COVID made us have that break. So basically forced us to have like a 4-month break. And then I started to feel really good again like within myself. I felt more normal. It was the best that I felt in like 2 years' time. And it was literally, I think it was down to the fact that I wasn't heading a ball in training. I wasn't heading a ball in when I was playing. And I think for me, it was that decision that, you know, I'll sit here and say it was an easy decision now because obviously the effects, but I spent hours having conversations with people, days just thinking about it. And actually, you know, it was the right thing for me to do because if I can't header a ball as a centre-back from a goal kick without feeling concussed, then I shouldn't be playing anymore. And it's like, it's that question, you know, what happens to me when I get to 50? Because it's unknown. It's unknown. Like,
yeah,
what are the long-term effects of what I've been doing for the past 25 years?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as you get a bit older, I think sometimes you start to appreciate what really matters in life. You know, if you've got your health, then you can pretty much crack on and do anything that you want to. So for me, it was, you know, I felt so much better and it was such a significant difference that I was just like, to continue to play isn't the right thing for me.
Yeah. And it must be a hard, obviously a heartbreaking decision, but when you put it like that and you're having to take a month off work, that's using your sick leave,
yeah,
effectively to take part in football. And it when you're not a Premier League men's player that's getting paid thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, you have to then consider, actually, if I continue playing and then I can't work,
yeah,
and I can't pay my bills, and it's a real shame that you have to then, you're forced to make those decisions. How are you feeling? Sorry, go on.
No, it wasn't easy. And like, you know, I remember being on the phone crying to my dad and being like, what do I do now? Like, who am I now? Like, what do I do? And he's like, you will figure it out. Like, you will be fine. It will be okay. And, you know, it has been. But at that point in time for me, I was like, am I ending who I am fundamentally? Because who am I without football?
Yeah, if you don't mind me asking, have you been working generally in the same role professionally throughout your football career?
No, so I used to work in the gyms and then I switched over. So I work at a university, so I work at King's College London. I worked in King's Sport running the gyms there for 5 years. And then I switched over last year just before the pandemic and everything hit and I moved into residences. And that was less demanding for me with my football because, say, I'd get home after a training session, I wouldn't get home till like 11:30, then I need to eat, then I need to shower, and then I'd get into bed, then I'd be up at then 5 o'clock to then get into work and open the gym. So then I switched over to residences, which then allowed me to then sleep in until like 7:00. Then I could get up. Then I could get ready and go into work for 9:00 rather than trying to be in at the gym ready to go at 6:00. And that
quality of life is priceless, isn't it?
And then, yeah. And then obviously from working from home now, like since obviously I've retired, I've just been like, what is this? Like all this time. So then I got a dog to fill my time and take out for walks all the time. So it's been, this last year has been a massive change for me, but all positive, definitely all positive things.
So you've obviously been filling the void left with obviously this little dog. Tell me about this little dog. I've had a little girl last year. She's one, and I'm kind of at a point where I think, right, next year, do we have another kid or do we get a dog? I'm dog broody.
He's a little whippet. We sort of rescued him from a farm, so he's unofficially a rescue. He's the sweetest thing going until he decides he doesn't want to be. But he's no ag at all. Like, we take him over to the park first thing in the morning. And again, that's something now I'm able to do, get up before work, take him to the park for an hour and then come home. And then he's just chill for the rest of the day. So I think we picked a good breed in with a whippet, even though we sort of just stumbled into that situation. And it was one of those, we were driving down to Southampton to see him. And, you know, when you're on your way and you're like, there's no way we're coming back without this dog. But he's a little superstar, to be fair to him. He puts up with me, keeps me company. And I'll send like the work lot photos every now and then being like, oh, this is my company in my own home office today. So and they love him. He's got quite a cute face, to be fair. So we've done all right with him.
Oh, they're amazing. If I have my way, it would be a Springer Spaniel that we get. Yeah. But in real terms, as full-time workers, I think we might opt for maybe the miniature Dachshund. I lived in a house that my friend had two of them. And they're beautiful little dogs.
Yeah, they are sweet. They're really sweet.
Yeah. A little hot water bottles, if you're soft and you let them come, let them sleep in your bed, they just crawl into the bottom down by your feet.
He's like that. Yeah, given any opportunity for a cuddle, like even if you get a blanket on the sofa, then you see this little head pop up and you're like, you were dead asleep literally a second ago. But if there's a opportunity for a cuddle and get under a blanket, he's there.
Yeah, and you never say no.
No, not when they look at you like all sweet. You're like, oh, yeah, of all things I can't say no to. So having a cuddle on the sofa with him.
Oh, that's lush. Obviously, we could talk about this all day, so we're just quickly getting back on track.
Yep.
Obviously, where you've been so heavily affected with head injuries, I believe that you've been doing a lot of work in your retirement with organisations that also specialise in that. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah.
And how it's been going?
So I work as an ambassador for the Scores Project, and that's a lot of research around dementia and football. And I've tried, you know, to really get involved in it, mainly because I think it's really important for people to understand what people go through, the long-term effects and things like that. And I'm not old enough yet to take part in the research itself. So I just messaged Dr. Michael Gray, who runs the research project, and just said, look, like, this is my situation. I know I'm not old enough to do the research, but can I please help out where I can? So I have done, you know, a few chats, few presentations, things like that. And for me, it's just about making people aware of it. Like, you know, I always get asked the question, oh, you know, should people stop headering the ball in football? And I'm like, for me, like, that's not my decision. I think if you took that away from my game, then you'd lose a huge element of strength. But you need to educate people around the effects of it. The players, you know, they have a responsibility to educate themselves, but also so do the management. And I've always said the main reason why I've wanted to get involved is because if I was in exactly the same position at 23 years old, I would 100% still be playing, and that's not right.
Yeah. Yeah. I know we saw it quite recently this weekend. We discussed the incident in the Rangers match where Brianna Westrup received a head injury.
Yeah.
And the image circulating from that, it's, you say an egg on the head. There's no exaggeration. It's the bump is that sort of size. And the Rangers women website, so the Twitter feed, it just described what that after receiving treatment, you know, the game resumes. There is no way in the world that the player probably can't see it. So fair enough.
Yeah.
But every single person around her should have said, nah, Brianna, mate.
I'm not sure how and why they made that decision, because if it was any normal person in any situation, even though they weren't playing football, for example, whatever they would be doing, you'd be going, right, you need to go straight to hospital. I don't understand why that decision was made to let her carry on. Like, that's beyond me. And obviously, like, you know, it's up to the player ultimately. How are you feeling? Do you feel okay? But sometimes the players need protecting from themselves. And I think that's where, you know, the physio and the medical staff, they've probably done all the tick box exercises that they've been required to do. But the question for me is that enough? Because I passed all the tick box questions and tests, and then literally 30 seconds later had a seizure.
Yeah.
So if it was up to me at that point in time, I would have gone back on the pitch and played. But it was the physio that was just like, no, this is a friendly. It's not worth it. Come off for like 10 minutes and then we'll see how you feel.
Yeah. So I guess you must agree with me that it's almost a no-brainer that they bring in the concussion substitutions.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think, you know, I think WSL have them now, but I'm not sure it's been used. Or if it has, I've missed it. But I think I don't understand why that's just not a thing across the board, because surely if you're protecting players' health, then surely a change has to be made.
Your concussions that you received, were they all heading the ball, or were they impact with other players? Or
the first two were actually, I ended up banging heads with players. But then the last one, which seemed like the less severe one, but actually gave me the most aggravation afterwards was headering the ball.
Yeah.
And that's when I made that decision, because I was like, if I can't header a ball, like, not everybody bangs heads with somebody else, but if I can't header a ball without feeling this way, then that's football.
Is there any advice that you would give a player or coach who's involved in football that might encounter this situation at any level, be that professional through to youth football?
I think for me, it would be like, from a player to a player, like, take care of yourself, because, and this isn't a negative towards anybody else, but like, you will get replaced ultimately. Like, you will either get subbed out and somebody else would, like, your shoes will be filled one way or the other. So you need to take care of yourself more so than anyone else. But for like the clubs, coaches, medical staff, like, players are people. You have to treat people the way that you'd want your child to be treated. And I think sometimes players get seen as like just items. And I think that's where it's like, oh, are you feeling okay? Yeah, good. Okay, get back on. As opposed to actually how are you feeling? Because I guarantee that Rangers player probably wasn't feeling great, but didn't want to say, oh, I want to come off.
Yeah. And you then think the coach might feel, oh, I've got pressure to win, so therefore they're a good player, so I want to keep them on.
It's the pressure of the game, and, you know, you never know what sort of financial benefit there is. And, you know, like, I don't blame anybody for getting caught up in the game, because we've all been there. But I think sometimes people need to take a step back and realise, like, these are human beings. Like, if someone's got a lump on their head like that, like, why are they not going to hospital now? Like, right now, rather than, oh, maybe after the game, see how you feel. Like, what?
So obviously we touched on Brianna Westrup, who had the egg or the golf ball, as you want to put it. But what about the impact that you might not be able to see? If we've got any coaches or players listening to this, what should they be looking out for, telltale signs that they might be suffering at some point?
I think, you know, make sure you're aware. And I'd say this to any player before playing, is like, make sure you're aware of how you feel. Like how your sleep patterns are, like how long you can be on a screen, because those were the telltale signs for me. It's like, I was sleeping 12 hours flat. And like I said to you before, like, I was lucky before if I got 6 hours. So I wasn't used to that. And then I felt really airy and my ears were constantly ringing. But I think, you know, try before anything happens, as part of like pre-season, I think it should be part of pre-season screening. Like, how do you feel? Like, how often do you, like, what's your sleep quality like? How long do you normally sleep? Like, how long are you normally exposed to a screen? Does that have an effect on you? And, like, just little things like that. Because I found with me, like, as time went on, I'd be like, oh, no, I'm 100%. I'm good to go. And then it's like 2 weeks later, I look back and go, I was not okay 2 weeks ago. But you end up in this state and that becomes your norm. And then you get into this conflict of, do I feel better? Do I feel normal? Am I okay or am I not okay? And then I think that becomes really confusing. So anybody who's not sure, honestly, I would just say talk to the people around you and just have an open and honest conversation about how maybe you've been behaving. If you've been slightly different, not saying it has to be bad, but like, have you been behaving differently to what you normally are? And, you know, if you surround yourself with good people will tell you.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a real sensible thing. It could be any little thing, to falling asleep in front of the television, to just being slightly lethargic, that it's probably quite easy to just blame on something else. But looking at that bigger picture, and it's one thing that I think we as a website will certainly try and push and share with this episode on social media. And me as a coach, I work within Havant and Waterlooville under 15 girls, and also our league's rep side. And it's something that I think that I'll probably even bring up with the league. We touched on earlier about the participation with women's and girls football. Youth girls football in Hampshire is fantastic. There are more in our under 15 set age group. There are more girls teams than there are any other boys teams in any other league. And there's a whole host of things. I've actually through this role of speaking to players, I've kind of got a little list that actually I need to bring up in the next AGM, as because let's face it, we do have some mums that are coaches, and some young female coaches. But it, as you can imagine, it's 98% dads, and dads that are in their sort of 40s, 50s, maybe on the cusp of 60s. And there are so many things that we need to consider, that being one of them. I've one of the other things on that list is just simple things like I've put in feminine hygiene products in our kit bag. So our players know that they can just, I had one player that she said, well, can I phone my mum? And I was like, if it's for what I think it is, just have a look in the bag.
Yeah.
And they can think, oh okay. And it kind of, it removes that embarrassment, that taboo. But yeah, there's so much that we can do to, and that's a whole other episode in itself.
Yeah. I think sometimes as well, like coaches and clubs and things like that are like, oh, but we're waiting for to be told what we have to do. Why? Yeah. I get that. But why are you waiting to ask somebody how they are? Like, and that's something like, you know, I really admired about Kenny, because he would take time out of his day to be like, right, let's go have a, you know, coffee and a catch up and just a chat. And it's like, you know, especially with Championship and where we were with Palace, is like, coaches also have full-time, you know, work outside of what they're doing. And sometimes, like, you know, we weren't able to get on the pitch because there were games happening before we got on there for training. So even like if we wanted to show up and do long range passing, you couldn't, because so like I don't blame anybody for, you know, all the time that they, or the lack of time that they have, and wanting to utilize every single moment of it. But at the same time, like for me, like the question of how are you actually doing, not how are you, like how are you, really actually matters. And I was reading, I think slightly off topic, but Roman Kemp released a documentation around men's mental health recently. And he has this thing where he says, we ask, how are you, twice. Like, how, like, because everyone's like, oh, hey, how are you? And you always say, oh, yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you? And he's like, no, but how are you? So they always ask their mates twice, how are you? Because the first thing, you always brush it over, don't you?
Yeah, it's really frustrating, especially during lockdown when you haven't seen someone. The amount of times that I've had to say, even not from a welfare perspective, more just a, come on, this is me. Not, I haven't seen you in 4 months.
Yeah.
Like,
fill me in.
We're not acquaintances. What's been going on? I know your parents. How are they doing? Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, sorry. You just force of habit, they break into this sort of standard answer. It's, no, I've asked you a genuine question. We're like, I'm interested in the answer. And I think it definitely makes a big difference. And even from a football perspective, bring it back to these, to under 15s, I've learned more in the last 3 years coaching girls youth football than I have it, with regards to player coach interaction, than I have in the 20 years prior. Yeah. It's the girls are so intelligent. All of them are intelligent. And when I first started coaching under 13 level, they were just little girls, basically little girls running around. And then they start to become more sassy, and their demands raise, the demands of me. I can't blag. If I'm trying to coach them to do something, they want to know why.
Yeah.
And if they're not satisfied with the answer, then, and they'll say, like, oh, but it doesn't happen in the men's professional game. They get more time on the ball. Well, yeah, but we're not playing in the men's professional game. I really recall one exercise we did where it was simulating a packed midfield, where I had half of the team in the middle third, where there was only like four players, maybe an attacker and a defender just in the others. But this doesn't happen in a match, and it does in a match. But it doesn't. I'm not surrounded by this many players, but you are, but you don't necessarily kind of see it. And I will find that there'll just be days where they're not on it. They're not naughty or disrespectful, but they're just chatting. And it's only when I've actually spoken to them and say, kind of couple of, like, what's going on? You don't, like, I can tell something's like, oh, this has happened at school. Yeah. Or I might speak to someone and they'll say, oh yeah, so and so, that's happened at school, and it's really easy to forget, especially as an adult that's been out of school for 20 odd years, that actually some of these things do have an impact. And sometimes if I'm trying to do something complex on the pitch, actually I need to be able to identify when the girls just need a bit of a blowout and they just need to play football if they want to run around.
It's the same concept with adults. We know, especially in the championship, like we're all working. So if someone's had a really rough day at work, and this is something that I'd always be like, I was always quite good at noticing, again, like when people's like auras were off or if they didn't see themselves. And I'd be like, right, what's going on? And they'd be like, oh, no, nothing. And you'd be like, no, come on, what's going on? And then you'd always find out. Yeah. And you'd be like, and then I'd like talk to the gaffer and be like, look, like, don't get on their case if they're having a bad session. Like, they've got enough on their plate. Like, just leave it out. And then they bounce back. But I think sometimes, again, it's just that, it's just remembering, like, everyone's human and everyone's going through all sorts of different things at different points in time. And, you know, to be able to get every single person in peak performance at the same time is very rare.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Obviously, we touched on Sherelle earlier, someone that I know personally. And when I've spoken to her, she'll say, obviously, she's traveling, she's finishing training and getting home at 11 p.m. Like you say, then you're having your dinner, showering. And then all it takes is just being late off work and you'll rush it. You've got 2 hours to drop, potentially 2 hours to get to training. And like any normal human being, your anxiety's up. You're kind of stressed. And it's really nice that she can have teammates like yourself that can just go over and just kind of like grab and be like, it's all right, mate. Wait, start
is,
again.
Well,
you're
like
here
you
now.
Those are the days you end up picking silly injuries because mind's not where it needs to be because you're worrying about something else, you're stressing about something else, and you pull up and it's like the last thing that you need on your plate is then pick up a silly injury.
Yeah, definitely. But I'm mindful we've been talking for over an hour now. It's a really sunny afternoon and I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I have got other questions that we can go on to with regards to your future in the game and coaching, but maybe we'll cover that when you're announced in the Northern Ireland coaching setup or you're the next Crystal Palace manager.
Absolutely.
That can be a topic for another day. But firstly, just thank you for taking the time out. And secondly, thank you for being so open and honest and sharing some really important themes. And I look forward to kind of sharing these with our listeners and following the rest of your career. And thank you again.
No problems. I might bump into you for the Euros next year. Yeah, get
fingers
on.
Fingers crossed.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.